are the topics that we'll be discussing tonight. Firstly, to try and get an understanding of what actually drives young Muslims to radicalism. With the events of 7/7 last year, with the September 11th bombings, with the recent controversy over the cartoons and so on, there is a lot of anger being expressed, as we see in the media, and inshallah this will be an attempt to actually try and understand what motivates young Muslims, especially young Muslim men, to engage in these activities. There's an argument within the intelligentsia that Islam needs a reformation of some sort along similar lines to that which happened with Christianity, and inshallah we'll be hoping to address that as well. There'll also be a review of the legal injunctions on warfare. What is jihad? How is jihad actually conducted and for what reasons? And an explanation of the verses of the Quran that are used to justify indiscriminate attacks, some which do seem to be outside the spirit of Islam, especially when taken in the wider context. Inshallah, we'll be concluding with highlighting a fatwa which examines the issue of targeting civilians and also the legality of suicide bombings. We have put a code of conduct for the day as well. Inshallah, there will be an opportunity for people to ask the speakers questions. We do request that any question that you have should be relevant to the talk itself. There are question and answer papers available, and inshallah, if you can direct them at a particular speaker, then engage with them then. In an effort to try and keep the whole talk Islamic and to show respect both for the speakers who have taken the time out to come and be here with us today and also for the audience, we ask that nobody else attempts to actually shout their voice or voice their opinions. If you do want to have a conversation with anybody, inshallah, come at the end of the lecture and we'll be more than happy to take it from there. If I can get started, what I'd like to do firstly is to introduce Dr. Tahir Abbas. He's a senior lecturer at Birmingham University. As well as being an expert on race equality, ethnicity and multiculturalism, he's also done studies in British Muslims. He's currently working on a project called British Islam, The Road to Radicalism, which is due to be published by Cambridge University Press. If I can call Dr. Abbas.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much to IMAD for the opportunity to be here and talk to you about this very important subject. I'm going to talk for about 20-25 minutes. I know we're running a little late, but I don't want to concentrate too many things in this discussion. I know there is a lot of what I say to be found in the introductory chapter to the book that has been superbly published by Amal Press, and I encourage all of you to pick up at least one copy, if not more. But nevertheless, I'm going to be focusing on some of the issues I've raised in that in relation to what drives Islamic political radicalism and what we can do in terms of developing solutions to that. I think before we can do any of that, we need to be sure about what the issues are, and I'm going to try and spell them out from a sociological and a political science perspective. So apologies in advance for the lack of theology that you might perhaps wish to see. Certainly there'll be a lot more of that later on today. So in the current climate in Britain and more widely in Western Europe, there is this phenomenon of the indigenous-born, native-language-speaking Muslim youth increasingly politicized by a radicalized Islam. What this actually means is a combination of complex notions of cultural, economic, social, and political dislocation compounded by national and international neo-Orientalist and Islamophobic political and media discourse in a context where the international climate is replete with references to Islamic and terrorist. Suffice to say, as ethnic minority communities in Western Europe, in Western European nation states, where these groups are also Muslim, the patterns are remarkably similar in relation to migration, settlement, adaptation, and issues in relation to integration and radicalism. Post-war groups were either invited or came searching for improved economic opportunities. But they've largely found their young growing up in societies which exhibit prejudice, discrimination, racism towards Muslim minority communities. When local education tends to be limited for the young, this isn't a universal experience, obviously. There are cases where we do find people performing rather well. But where there is a general tendency for education to be limited, it affects the likelihood of securing effective labor market entry. And what that does, it also prevents individuals and communities from stabilizing and also becoming good citizens, i.e. good taxpayers and voters. There also emerge intergenerational tensions as a result of language, culture, and attitudes towards majority communities. Invariably, as the process of adaptation begins to evolve, there is an adjustment to majority society in subsequent generations of migrant communities. At times, there is resistance, as in the case of a few who seek integration, who see integration as a negative feature in their life in liberal, secular nation states. Such an existence is regarded by some as somewhat antithetical to the life of a good Muslim. Others for whom integration has been positively approached, a sense of dislocation and alienation perceive the real impacts on the psyche. It encourages some to seek out Muslim issues in lands away from home, which are often politically subverted by radical interest groups, and often carrying out horrific acts of violence, invariably involving the annihilation of the self in the process and in the name of Islam. For the non-Muslim community, who aren't any the wiser, it's only too easy to assume that the one are somehow related to the other. So what's more specific about the British case? We know from secondary statistics that we have 1.6 million Muslims in this country, of whom around 1 million are from South Asia, 750,000 are from Pakistan, of which around half, if not up to two-thirds, are from the Kashmir region. So we have 1 in 3 Muslims who are approximately from very unique part of Pakistan. We also find that these groups tend to be largely concentrated in the Midlands and in the north, where as a result of post-war deindustrialization, the closing down of factories and so on, high rates of unemployment and a kind of social exclusion, multiple layers of deprivation disadvantage sit on top of each other, excluding communities from majority society. So that, you know, the picture tends to be in the north and in the Midlands. But in the south, we do know that there are different patterns in relation to integration. We have 1 million Muslims in London alone, 1 in 7 of all Londoners are Muslim. But every nationality, cultural, ethnic origin is represented in relation to the picture in relation to Islam in London. And there are, because it's a city which is the heartbeat of the economy, it's also one in which that has been more successful to a large extent in integrating many of the Muslim minorities there. Certainly in relation to education, less of an issue per se than it is for the Midlands or in the North, where the Muslims tend to underachieve in relation certainly to other South Asian groups. So what we have here is a combination of these historical factors that have negatively impacted on integration. So these sort of low social class positions, coupled with religious and cultural isolation, not necessarily a result of self-segregation, more about hostility from majority society, place many young people's experiences outside the spheres of wider social life. There are also intergenerational tensions in relation to tradition. For example, the insistence on consanguineous marriages by some South Asian parents. Many young Muslims object, which encourages some to return to a more literal interpretation of Islam, often as a source of empowerment from culture, which impacts negatively. This development encourages young Muslim minds to explore further, but parents cannot provide the knowledge, as they often lack the linguistic, intellectual, and cultural skills to communicate with their children, even though they often experience a reinvigorated approach to the religion themselves. The mosques, for the most part, provide a relatively open learning environment, but the information, on the whole, tends to be at a very basic level, always geared within a particular and specific linguistic and cultural framework, largely because of limited capacity. As a result, many, many factors drive young people to seek alternative forms of empowerment knowledge, whether it is via the internet or through new other forms of new media, or through mosques and study circles. These messages are often tainted with a radicalizing tone that promotes intolerance, antipathy, and the general disregard for all things Western. And they also emerge outside from traditional Sunni Islam and are more a function of what is loosely described as a Salafi thought. which would be described as a return to the first few years of Islam, and based on very selective and sometimes dubious interpretation of sacred texts. Much of this thinking appealed to a small number of young Muslims, and it must be said that it's mostly men, although not entirely, who see this as a form of liberation from the traditions, norms and values of their own communities, and from nation states, which can often seek to subjugate Muslim minorities, home and abroad. Throughout the 1990s, we've seen lots of examples of Salafi-type organizations influencing minds. Since then, we've had organizations such as Al-Majrun, supporters of Sharia, and Hizb ut-Tahrir have had much success in infiltrating university Islamic societies throughout Britain, before their actions began to be viewed with suspicion, particularly around the late 1990s. More internal to the community, young Muslims are able to observe what's been going on in the wider Islamic world in relation to Bosnia, Kashmir, Chechnya, Palestine, and so on, and have been affected as any other Muslim might be. Seeing that the wider events in the Muslim world, as well as the way in which organizations have adapted to the political ideologies, seeing it as an opportunity in which to channel their grievances and their gripes. And it seemingly ticks a whole series of boxes: social exclusion, political disempowerment, intergenerational tension, racism, discrimination. And by turning to a more radical message in relation to Islam, their actions are therefore legitimized from their point of view. Pitted as a battle between good and evil, angry young Muslims, fueled by Occidentalist sensationalism, see Western nation states as the enemy. And this rhetoric is used both by George W. Bush and Osama bin Laden in an attempt to invigorate their following. And this is the idea of the clash of fundamentalisms. And an excellent book by Tariq Ali, who is a scholar, a historian and a political activist, is very interesting in terms of mapping out this picture. And many who have been involved in so-called alleged terrorist activities have been South Asian Muslim, but not all. A number have also been African Caribbean reverts. They have not all been necessarily poor. We talk about alienation as a driver. Some have been attending universities. They experience prejudice, racism, and discrimination throughout their early lives and sustain themselves in education in spite of it, in spite of its limitations in relation to Muslims. But hoping to find the truth, they were ultimately misdirected by radicalizing Islamists seeking to convert apparently once decadent young Muslims, or those yearning for a more literal interpretation. A sense of belonging, identity, and association with a struggle that transcends the everyday boundaries and barriers, theologically, metaphysically, and spiritually, some Islamists have moved with a twisted message. At the international and national level, it is without that doubt that the politics of George W. Bush in the USA and Tony Blair in Britain have helped to further radicalize Muslims here. This is certainly what Mohammed Sadiq Khan, who in a tape video message broadcast on Al Jazeera TV on the 1st of September said, "Your democratically elected governments continuously perpetuate atrocities against my people all over the world." The ways in which Muslim prisoners have been treated in Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib prisons at the hands of Americans, and the revelations of the extent of abuse inflicted by the British Army on Iraqi prisoners serves only to further disillusion an already disenfranchised British Muslim community. Since 9/11, throughout much of the Western world, changes to international finance, anti-terrorist legislation, and debates around identity cards, citizenship, rights and obligations have all seen the nation state seemingly tighten its grip on Muslim minorities. Many commentators have argued that the war on terror has revealed itself to be an ideological construction, helping to maintain the status quo while Muslims are derided, misrepresented, incarcerated, and in general made to feel and think that they're unwanted. So too has been a shift towards regarding Muslims as the enemy within, as an undifferentiated mass of Arab terrorists, as groups who are overly demanding of their religious and cultural rights, i.e. problems vis-a-vis problems with multiculturalism, and a people unwilling to integrate into majority society. I'm reminded of the Salman Rushdie affair of 1989 and how the Kashmiri and Pakistani communities were vilified at the time. And it is somewhat poignant today that it is the same set of people when we are discussing issues of integration, community, identity and loyalty to the state on one hand, and problems of education, employment, housing, health and so on the other. Now, such was the initial post-war economic, social and political subordination of this group of people. Other Muslims tend to be conspicuously absent in this discourse around the problems of Muslims in Britain today. A lot of it, indirectly and directly, is aimed at predominantly South Asian Muslims and in certain parts of the country, i.e. the North and in the Midlands. And it is clear to see how the impact of social class, ethnicity and, to some extent, gender impacts on how the Muslims in Britain reference is framed and in relation to particular groups. So, at a time when the Western world is globalizing at an ever rapid rate, questions in relation to what it means to be a Muslim minority are at the forefront of debates in policy, government, media and academia. Many discussions emerge on radicalization, secularization, modernization, identity conflict, intergenerational change, cultural relativism, and social and economic alienation. Now, those on the left of the political spectrum, we don't have much of a left in this society, but those that exist, see that the war on terror and structural inequalities are at the heart of the problem, while those on the right feel it's all about the very essence of a religion that is seen as alien, barbaric, or ill-adjusted to the expectations and aspirations of the West. The fact of the matter is that it is neither the religion which is solely central, nor the material realities of isolated British Muslims, nor indeed foreign policy. They are all as important in this sensitive equation. Today, as Muslims, we too are looking inside the British Muslim community at large to determine what might be at fault within, at the same time as the foreign policies of George W. Bush and Tony Blair have created havoc in distant lands without. The global context has been the self-fulfilling prophecy of the clash of civilizations thesis, a general theory, originally formulated by neoconservative ideologues such as Bernard Lewis, Samuel Huntington, and Francis Fukuyama. The stark realities of the 1990s and the early years of the 21st century have revealed a whole host of examples where Muslims throughout the globe have suffered immeasurably. The first Gulf War, to Somalia, Bosnia, Chechnya, second Palestinian Intifada, the war in Afghanistan, and the war on Iraq, we see it unraveling on a daily basis. Muslims have been at the receiving end of the political and economic interests of Western hegemonic discourse. While there are 20 million Muslims in Western Europe and around 6 million in the USA, we have witnessed various reactions to this onslaught, some internally derived, others externally influenced. From the attacks on the Paris metro, to the Moscow theater attack in 2002, the Madrid bombings in 2004, which was just been 2 years, where 200 people were killed, and the assassination of Theo van Gogh in the Netherlands, and the first ever suicide bombings by homegrown radicals in Europe. British-born Islamic political radicals struck London. Now, in the chapter of the book, I try to explore a number of factors which are important in trying to understand what drives young people to do the things that they invariably did last July. And I'm going to largely skip much of that because I think you can pick up copies of the book and find out for yourself. But effectively, I'm talking about the cultural factors, the structural factors around economic, social exclusion, and the international issues around the war on terror, and the way in which Muslim lands have been subjugated, and of course, a look at critically at the theology which drives the Salafi orientated kind of narrow interpretation of Islam. Okay. Now, I'm just going to kind of try and trying to kind of piece this together. The problems of radicalism are multi-layered and multifaceted. For a young man to make the final step to suicide bomber, he has to experience complete social, cultural, generational, political, and degrees of economic marginalization compounded by a distorted outlook to life, as well as a sheer selfishness to click that final switch. The irony is that those who might regard what they are doing as acceptable will probably state the opposite, that what they do is for Muslims, for social justice, for humanity. It is a rare combination for any young British Muslim man to take those final steps. But unfortunately, it could be argued, should the status quo remain in relation to vis-a-vis the rest of the Muslim world, and the way in which British Muslims have been continued to be vilified and misrepresented in the press and in general political discourse, that the potential for this to happen again is still very much there. Many factors are important in trying to work out what drives radicalism. But what is important depends more on the political position taken by the commentator rather than any subjective or objective evaluation. But what is absolutely clear is the interconnectivity of the different factors. How we view this phenomenon is more about how we see ourselves as much as it is about how we want to be seen. Consequently, the combination of the internal and the external, a juxtaposition of the local, national, international places Muslims in the West in precarious positions. They see the wider Islamic world in tatters and their own experiences affected by dominant domestic paradigms. But in reality, mainstream Islam has no direct answers. What a few young Muslim people, mostly men, do is to seek solutions to their frustrations in violence and destruction. Little do they realize that they help no one and only create further distress, disharmony, and disillusionment. Now, it's quite apparent that Islam in the West and elsewhere too is in need of a new impetus. We talk about a reformation, but that might be a little bit beyond our immediate needs. Given the anti-discrimination laws of this country and the openness of British society, certainly compared to our European counterparts, one must hope that it's a real possibility that we can work out solutions here and for others to learn from our understandings. Certainly the 7/7 attacks on London have added to direct and indirect forms of Islamophobia. There is considerable evidence of violence towards individuals, communities, institutions, impacting on the experience of Muslims who live in Britain further, and particularly those who are visible adherents located in marginalized communities all over the country, further increasing fear and distrust of majority society. The important thing to do is to ensure that the events of 7 July never happen again. If so, there are likely to be too great a set of repercussions that would seriously harm civil liberties, lead to additional draconian anti-terrorist legislation, and further alienate a body of young people who are at the margins of society. To achieve success, one needs to enter into dialogue with young Muslim men and to remove the barriers that prevent this from occurring. The conversation needs to be direct and specific, but the conduit of existing community leaders has proven to be anything but effective. If anything, the events of July last year have spelled the death of the existing Muslim community leader, whether they are political, cultural, or intellectual. Theologically, although the voices of Tariq Ramadan and Sheikh Hamza Yusuf are popular with the British state, they are but a small brand of progressive Islamic scholars, and their longevity is dependent upon current political machinations. In the end, the potential for Islamic political terrorism will not go away so easily, because the roots will not go away so easily. They are a matter of economic and social concern as much as they are of Britain's foreign policy. There is a deep-seated malaise that is at the heart of many of the problems of Islamic political radicalism in Europe. Interventions in Muslim lands, where economic imperatives are disguised as political developments to democracy and freedom, being the main botched Bush, Blair endeavors are seen as humanitarian interventions, necessary evils, or at the very worst, mistakes. To suggest anything more critical is to be considered absurd by the intelligentsia or the popular press. And at the local level, the poorer Muslim communities who are increasingly segregated, poor Muslim communities living next door to very poor white communities, non-Muslim communities, tend to reveal in the greatest tensions. Calls for the death of segregation, sleepwalking into, calls for the death of multiculturalism and sleepwalking into segregation, are all political developments to the events of 7/7. The failure to act is the failure of conversation. It is also a failure to be genuinely honest about the nature of the problems and their foundations. Okay, that's really all I wanted to say. A few rambling thoughts, if you like, around the nature of the British Muslim position today from an economic, sociological, and political perspective, linked to wider concerns in the rest of the Muslim world, where Muslims are minorities or majorities, and how those tensions away from home can impact on tensions more closer to home. And certainly what we're doing as academics is thinking very hard and trying to come up with very robust solutions to this problem so that it doesn't affect us again. And I think we have to take real responsibility for this, apart from the fact that the war on terror and foreign policies of Western governments have been an important part in this. We too have to take responsibility inside ourselves as Muslim communities of all ethnicities and cultural backgrounds to ensure nothing like this quite happens again. Okay, thank you for your time. Thank you.
Jazakallah.